Support for The World's Podcast comes from LegalZoom. With over 17 years and more than 2 million customers, LegalZoom provides helpful support, legal advice, and transparency for business owners. More information at LegalZoom.com/world.
Fighting disaster together in Mozambique, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. People in Mozambique are rallying to help each other in the wake of Cyclone Idai.
I have witnessed immense unity from the people here. All these people mobilized each other on social media.
Also, the saga of Brexit may be careening to an end.
Order! Miss Order!
We'll have an update, plus a college grapples with historical racism on campus.
I remember sometimes leaving the campus and I felt like my stomach was in knots.
And the sister of Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, on what guides this controversial leader?
All I can say is in his heart, he's guided by God.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. By so many measures, the devastation caused by Cyclone Idai in southern Africa is off the charts. The storm caused flooding that's been described as an inland ocean. Hundreds of people died, and with some 15,000 people still in need of rescue in Mozambique alone, the UN is calling it the largest disaster ever in the southern hemisphere. Zimbabwe and Malawi have also been affected. Right now, the priority remains rescuing the living and getting food, medicine, and shelter to people impacted across the region. We reached the BBC's Anne Soy at a makeshift donation center in the capital of Mozambique, Maputo. You can hear the volunteers working in the background.
There are two human chains offloading donations from a truck that has just arrived. They're being taken into a warehouse where they'll be distributed. Repackaged into smaller packs that can be given to families in need and then shipped up north to Beira.
What have you seen? What have you witnessed in the last 24 hours?
I have witnessed immense unity from the people here. All these people mobilized each other on social media, came together here, took up one warehouse at the seaport, and they have been calling for donations. I have seen individuals coming here with cooking pots, companies donating up to 50 tons of rice. They hope to have filled up 40 shipping containers and then they will be shipped up north to Beira. Cyclone Idai has completely destroyed that city. Some people have gone without food for 7 days.
What kind of aid have you been seeing coming in? What's the scope of it?
So we've seen foodstuff of all kinds. High-energy biscuits have been distributed by the World Food Programme. They've had to airdrop some of them to communities who are trapped in small islands that have been created by the water. The UK government has donated shelters for the families that have left without homes. The World Health Organization and MSF have been distributing water purifiers, essential medicines, because they expect that because of the flooding, it's going to create more problems with disease outbreaks, and all that is anticipated. So they are distributing medicines as well.
The BBC's Anne Soy on a satellite phone at a busy aid distribution center in Maputo, Mozambique. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Anne.
Thank you for having me.
Anne also told me that Mozambique's president and cabinet are leading the aid effort in the hardest-hit city, the one she just mentioned, Beira. And that's important because locally-led relief efforts are often better positioned to save lives and protect their communities than their international counterparts. That's according to Amy Costello. She hosts Tiny Spark, a podcast devoted to how the aid community works.
There's talk of setting up these mega camps, two of them apparently, according to the World Food Program. And that brings about a number of concerns when you're trying to centralize, you know, aid in that way in these large camps.
Yeah, I mean, just the word camp alone. I mean, we know that the dependencies that aid can lead to, mm-hmm. especially massive amounts of aid. So how does supplying that aid start to raise these political and ethical questions?
Well, it's all about power, isn't it? Who has the aid and who doesn't? And those who wield the power, who wield the aid, we have seen, unfortunately, can abuse that power. And I think also in a country like Mozambique and other nations in this area, there's many people who are spread out in very rural areas. And so there are questions about how do we get aid to those who are most vulnerable, who are not in eyeshot of cameras and city centers.
Do you have an example, Amy, of how you saw this power dynamic play out during the time you were based in Southern Africa?
I've been to food aid distributions, and in an ideal situation, they are highly regulated because there are all kinds of opportunity for corruption and abuse to take place. There's so many people desperate to get their hands on that aid that you have to be very careful that the powerful people, whether they have weapons or muscles or just political power, don't take the aid and keep it from those who need it most. And so, you know, what I saw were best case scenarios where there is order and structure to food distributions, to medical delivery. And that's really kind of imperative and yet will be the ultimate challenge given the incredible challenges that the country is facing right now. But yes, I've seen the way that humanitarian aid can be abused. I've seen the way that UN peacekeepers and other quote-unquote helpers can abuse local populations once they get in there. So yeah, there's lots of things to be concerned about, and I've seen them myself, and many other people have reported on them over the years in crises just like this one.
Obviously, just because well-intentioned aid efforts frequently lead to unintended results doesn't mean that generous aid shouldn't be sent to these people. But how do you make sure the aid isn't abused?
It's difficult to have oversight in the best of situations in many countries around the world, let alone after a disaster like this one. However, it's very important that people support these efforts, and people should certainly not be sending sweaters or old clothing or canned goods to Mozambique at this point. Cash is always best. These aid organizations also want people giving month to month, so have a little debit taken out of your account, because long after the cameras are gone, these people are going to still be struggling, in fact, probably suffering. And so if we can just have an ongoing charitable contribution to organizations that have a presence on the ground, who have a history in Mozambique and the other countries where they're working in, that's ideal. But they certainly need financial support, ideally cash. And I think we as international helpers or donors like to think that we can come in and we know best how to handle these situations. But time and time again, what we're learning more and more is the importance of true partnership and collaboration with Mozambicans so that they can plan their own future, they can chart the way ahead, and we are there to simply assist them getting them to where they want to go. And so I think looking for organizations who have those meaningful, long-term, historic partnerships on the ground already, pre-disaster, are the ones that we should be giving to post-disaster.
Amy Costello is a senior correspondent and investigations editor with the Nonprofit Quarterly. She's also the host of the podcast Tiny Spark. Amy, good to speak with you. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
This was pretty big news. President Trump said today that it's time for the U.S. to, quote, fully recognize Israel's sovereignty of the Golan Heights. That statement came in the form of a tweet. It wasn't entirely unexpected, but it also represents a significant reversal in U.S. policy going back more than 50 years. The World's Matthew Bell is here in the studio with me to put this in context. So a quick geography reminder, Matthew, the Golan Heights is where exactly?
From where I used to live in Jerusalem when I was Middle East correspondent, it's about a three-hour drive, basically go straight north. It's the high ground that sits up in that place where the borders meet between northern Israel, southern Lebanon, and Syria.
I feel like I haven't heard the words Golan Heights in years. Has control of the Golan Heights been in dispute?
Certainly not in Israel, in contrast to the West Bank, for example. The Israeli public is divided about what should happen with the West Bank. The Golan Heights, in terms of Israeli politics, not so controversial. Israelis across the board will see this announcement from Donald Trump and celebrate it. They'll say that, look, the Golan Heights is a lovely place. It's beautiful. You can go camping there. You can go skiing there. Israelis get water from there. Strategically, it's important. That's something Donald Trump mentioned in his tweet. Just across the board, Israelis will say, we're not going to give this land up.
So who will not like this announcement?
Well, it is an abrupt reversal of decades of U.S. policy. And also the entire international community recognizes the Golan Heights as land that was captured during conflict, the 1967 war. The Six-Day War is when the Israelis took control of the Golan Heights. Israel recognized the Golan Heights as under Israeli law in 1981, but no one around the world recognizes that. The rest of the international community sees it as occupied land, control over which should be determined through negotiations through other parties. Countries like Iran, Syria, maybe Russia, are not going to like this.
What about the timing? Because Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is scheduled to meet President Trump pretty soon in Washington. Any coincidence there?
Hard not to see this as a political gift to Netanyahu, who's facing what looks like it could be a tight political race. The national election in Israel is on April 9th. This will look very good for Prime Minister Netanyahu.
And what about the residents of the Golan Heights themselves? Like, who are they and what does this mean for them?
I think the people who live in the Jewish towns there, the Jewish Israelis, of course, they're going to say this is not a surprise. We live here. It's the Golan Heights has been part of Israel for a long time. It should continue to be. There's also the population of Druze Arabs. These are people that have long-time cultural religious connections across the border with Syria. They've always been sort of caught in the middle. Some of them are Israeli citizens. Some of them are actually still Syrian citizens. So this is just going to highlight that place that they've been stuck in for a long time.
The World's Matthew Bell. Thanks for filling us in.
Thanks, Marco.
Some people get uncomfortable talking about certain body parts, but not the people who launched a crowdfunding campaign today in Britain to fund construction of the first ever brick-and-mortar vagina museum. Florence Schechter has been working on this for a few years. She's the founder of the Vagina Museum Project, and we wanted to know where she got the idea from.
I found out there is a penis museum in Iceland, which is pretty cool. You know, big fan of penises. but there was no vagina equivalent anywhere in the world. There's this art gallery in Tasmania, and there's a virtual museum based in Austria, but there was no like physical museum that I could go visit. And I thought that was really unfair. So I was like, well, I guess I'm just making one now. And ours is going to be a bit different. Ours is going to be like exhibitions about the science, the history, the social aspect of it. So it's not just going to be like pictures of vaginas, although they are great, and pictures of vulvas. It's going to be much wider in its scope.
So what are you hoping that people will get out of visiting the Vagina Museum when it opens?
What I'm hoping that people will get out of it, I think number one, is that vaginas are normal and nothing to be ashamed of. It's a hugely stigmatized part of the body, and that leads to some really awful real-world consequences. You know, people are too embarrassed to go to their doctors when they're having symptoms, for example. And, you know, like when they finally go for their cervical smear, it's too late. And this stigma is really, really hurting people. So I think a museum would be a really great way of us as a community coming together and saying, actually, this is a part of the body that we should be celebrating, something we should be having conversations about. And hopefully that will have like knock-on consequences and make people more confident about their body. So the number one priority really is destigmatization of the gynecological anatomy.
On your website, it also says that the museum wants to be gender inclusive and intersectional. As far as attendance, I assume that means all genders are welcome. Inside the museum, though, what does that inclusivity look like?
Gender inclusivity is one of our really core values. Firstly, because everyone needs to learn about vaginas, no matter whether you have them or you don't, because, you know, half the population have them. We all come out of them. There's almost never a time when you're not going to interact with them. So you need to learn about them. What gender inclusivity also means, though, is that our actual exhibitions are going to be gender inclusive. So whether you like it or not, there are people who are not women who have vaginas. The fact of the matter is, I think we should all have the freedom to decide what we do with our own bodies. And so what that means is that in our exhibitions, we're going to be gender inclusive and recognize trans stories, recognize non-binary stories as part of the human experience.
So you hope that the Vagina Museum will kind of put everybody of all gender identity kind of on the same playing field?
Yeah, absolutely. I think all humans are equal.
You know, a lot of people have a hard time saying the word vagina and penis. Has it been challenging talking about this new museum publicly without people kind of resorting to, you know, teenage snickers?
That's an interesting question, because obviously vagina, the word vagina itself is not like a naughty word. Like, that's a scientific word.
Right.
But absolutely, people do laugh, people do snigger. But the funny thing is that when they see that you're treating it like a normal thing, they might laugh for a bit. And then they're like, oh, wait, why am I laughing? And then you just get over that initial shock and you can have a normal conversation. But the fact that people do laugh and snigger at the word vagina is exactly why we need the Vagina Museum.
Florence Schechter, the founder of the Vagina Museum, which is scheduled to open this fall. Thanks very much. Good to meet you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's something that the U.S. and other countries have struggled with, reconciliation after historical racism. South Africa had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission after the end of apartheid, but here in the U.S., efforts are less coordinated. So places like schools and colleges have been trying to figure out their own ways to bring their diverse communities together. Many have hired specialized administrators to handle diversity issues. The World's Rupa Shenoy spent time with one in Macon, Georgia.
The pictures taped to the door of Tonya Parker's office are of her years in college in the 1990s.
Look at me from when I was a student. Look at this, the computer. People laugh. The students are like, oh my gosh, that's a computer.
One picture is of her and her roommate, In Jung Lee, from South Korea. A few weeks after they moved in together, Parker remembers Lee suddenly turned unfriendly. Parker asked what was wrong, and finally, Lee said she'd heard things about black people from another student.
She had informed her that she needs to be cautious rooming with me, and she needs to make sure that she doesn't leave all her stuff in the room, and she's saying all this, and I think I was falling apart on the inside.
This was at Wesleyan College in Macon, a private school started in the early 1800s for upper-class white women. It became known for its international students in the early 1900s, after three sisters from China enrolled. One, Sung Mei Ling, went on to marry Chiang Kai-shek, the founder of Taiwan. There's a picture of her in the Wesleyan archives, sitting on some steps with other students, and they're all lined up in the shape of a K.
She's holding the K.
That's a K as in Ku Klux Klan. It was part of the identity of the school. Some of the yearbooks from the time had that on the cover. African Americans weren't admitted to the college until the 1960s. But now the all-female student body of about 700 students is 40% women of color and 15% international students. Wesleyan proudly says local students can experience the world just on campus. And that's why Tonya Parker came here. She eventually reconciled with her roommate after long discussions about race and American history. But there were still Wesleyan traditions that made Parker uncomfortable. Like once, another student woke her up and led her outside for a ceremony where everyone was wearing Klan-like hoods. Parker managed to slip away. She graduated and went on to do diversity and inclusion training for the Girl Scouts of America. Wesleyan recruited her back as an assistant dean of diversity and inclusion in 2016.
All right. Good evening, everybody.
One of her jobs was to hold diversity discussions. Students learn how to disagree constructively. She teaches them a series of steps. First, someone says something that upsets you.
How dare you say that? Okay, they will start saying these things to me, and I'll say, oh, that's interesting.
Be intentional about saying I heard you. Then ask questions. Listen to the answers without being defensive. Final step, provide information. The semester these sessions began, Donald Trump was elected president. Tensions rose across the country and were felt on campus. Wesleyan made the local news.
Students here say that they felt targeted by racist messages they found on their dorm room doors and walls when they returned.
One of those things read, "Go away, immigrant, hashtag Trump. The racial slurs so vulgar that we can't show you on air."
A few months later, Wesleyan again found itself in a media spotlight that left the campus reeling. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution published a story that reported an open secret. The school had historical links to the Ku Klux Klan that it had never formally acknowledged. It pointed to a practice students started in the early 1900s of giving every graduating class a name and color drawn from KKK culture.
It was the Purple Knights, the Golden Hearts, the Green Knights, and then the Red Pirates.
Junior Anna Marmalejo Rios is a student facilitator for Parker's diversity discussion.
A lot of people don't know. I didn't know when I got here.
Like that was all linked to the KKK.
That's senior Stacy Rice, another facilitator. She's retired from the military and came back to school.
Once that came out, then it was
problematic.
Yeah,
for everybody.
Yeah, because it was a lot of discord around the campus. I mean, they couldn't keep sweeping it under the rug. They had to address the issue.
Students and alumni whose families had been attending Wesleyan for generations argued the class names were a cherished school tradition, no longer connected to their origins.
Some of the students are like, well, my grandmother was this, or my grandmother was that,
so,
I want to be, yes, more like tradition.
Students talked about it in Tonya Parker's diversity discussions and came to a consensus that the class names, because of their KKK associations, should go.
Parker remembers it as a difficult time.
I remember sometimes leaving the campus and I felt like my stomach was in knots. I didn't think I was going to make it because it was so much just tension.
Administrators could keep the class names or get rid of them, and by doing so, condemn the school's history. Matt Martin is a Wesleyan assistant provost and English professor.
The purpose of a Wesleyan education was to educate women who would promote white supremacy. That was what it was for. And so to move from that foundation to a college now where our entering class has more non-white students than white students is a huge transition.
Martin says the administration decided Wesleyan needed to break from history. Last summer, they got rid of the class names. When this academic year started, each graduating class was only able to keep an identifying color. There is a view on campus that that change is silly and unnecessary, and I tried to get a hold of students and alumni who feel that way, but they didn't want to talk. Matt Martin says beyond a freshman orientation, students at Wesleyan don't have to take part in diversity and inclusion discussions.
It's a real challenge, I think, particularly, to be honest, for our white students. Often they can see these kinds of discussions about race and class as things that are threatening, things that make them feel guilty.
These kinds of things have been studied by places like the Southern Poverty Law Center. They recommend diversity discussions be worked into all classes and are not just the responsibility of a few administrators. For now, diversity discussions are a step in the right direction because they make students of color feel heard. And that seems to be what's happened at Wesleyan.
Because we have these different spaces, it provides students the opportunity to discuss, you know, how they feel.
Local student Jalen Dickerson is a senior psychology major.
I do think they are trying, and I also think that they know that if they don't work as a student body, we will make sure that the word gets out.
And that's why Tonya Parker has stayed at Wesleyan. Getting rid of the class names was a significant step. Parker says in at least one case, a parent said they were removing their student because Wesleyan wasn't the place they thought it was, and administrators let them go. But Parker still does face opposition from people who get defensive or aren't open to seeing things differently. There are new clashes on campus every day that cause her anguish. But for Parker, for now, the progress that's been made is worth it.
The students, when I could hear that they were changing in the way that they said they felt about things, it's like, okay, Wesleyan, you all are doing something. You do care about us. And then I know that the work has been paying off, and I feel really good about that.
The question for Parker is what happens now if progress will continue? For example, will Wesleyan force all faculty to take diversity seriously? Parker says the school's actions will determine how much trust she and students of color have in institutions to change. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Macon, Georgia.
I'm Marco Werman. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is deeply controversial. His sister compares him to Donald Trump and says their detractors have it all wrong.
They're not guided by Darth Vader. They're guided by the light of God.
We visit his hometown in the southern Philippines to learn how Duterte became Duterte. That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Britain is facing a national emergency. That's what British business and union leaders told Prime Minister Theresa May in a joint letter today. But it's not the only emergency the Prime Minister is facing. May's own Conservative Party is reportedly furious at her for something she said in a live TV address of The Nation last night. May laid the blame for the mess that is currently the UK's Brexit strategy squarely at the feet of her colleagues in Parliament. Today, the Prime Minister repeated those charges.
What is important is that Parliament delivers on the result of the referendum and that we deliver Brexit for the British people. I sincerely hope that we can do that with a deal. I'm still working on ensuring that Parliament can agree a deal so that we can leave in an orderly way. What matters is that we deliver on the vote of the British people.
May also traveled to Brussels for more talks with EU leaders. The World's Orla Barry has been following yet another tumultuous 24 hours in the whole Brexit saga. What's being discussed now, Orla? I mean, European leaders must be skeptical that May can get anything passed in the House of Commons.
Yeah, she leaves some disgruntled colleagues at home and she meets some disgruntled EU colleagues across the water in Brussels. At this point, she is looking for another extension to Brexit and she needs to persuade all EU leaders to come over on her side and to agree to an extension. The difficulty is that any extension that they agree to is conditional on the parliamentary MPs that she was so scathing of last night agreeing to her withdrawal deal. And if she was looking on shaky ground last week when we spoke, Marco, the backstabbing and infighting that she reported, that she told the public about last night, has only worsened today.
Wow. So we heard Theresa May telling the public last night that she understood they were tired of the infighting. It was high time politicians made a decision on the next step. So how's that going to impact what happens next?
Yeah, that certainly didn't go down well. What we thought she was going to say was that she was going to tell us she was getting ready to exit as party leader and prime minister. Instead, she told us that not only was she the only woman doing the right job and that she had the public's interests at heart, but that her parliamentary colleagues were the people who were responsible for the mess. They are furious today. Her colleagues, her Conservative Party colleagues are furious. Labour is furious. The Labour MPs today are talking about how she has raised the temperature to such an extent that they feel their lives could be in danger. The police came out a little bit earlier to say they're going to ensure that MPs can have their taxis allowed into the grounds of Parliament so they can get straight into their taxis home at night while within the grounds of Parliament so they can't be attacked by people who might be very angry with them. The temperature really has been raised. Have a listen to what John Bercow had to say. He's the speaker that you hear so often calling order, order in right. the Houses of Parliament and a Conservative colleague. But have a listen to what he had to say this morning.
None of you is a traitor. All of you are doing your best. This should not be, and I'm sure will not prove, to be a matter of any controversy whatsoever. From the chair, let me say that I believe passionately in the institution of Parliament, in the rights of members of this House, and in their commitment to their duty.
All right. What if they don't agree on a deal next week, Orla?
Well, as one correspondent said a little bit earlier, no one has the faintest idea where we'll be in a week's time. And when we're talking about a week's time, we literally are talking about 8 days. Don't forget, March 29th was the date that the UK was due to leave the EU. That could still happen. It could, by law, happen that the UK leaves the EU without a deal. Most people are hoping that won't happen. Businesses are hoping it won't happen. The medical services, etc., are all hoping it won't happen. And most parliamentarians are hoping it won't happen. So there are other options. There is an option for a possible longer extension from the EU. Again, that's down to all the EU leaders to agree to. But also, it raises the prospect of, can Theresa May be the woman who leads the ship then, if that were to be the case? The Labour Party may well suggest, as has been suggested in the past, that maybe a general election might be the road to go down. Could there be a second referendum? Or indeed, could they revoke Article 50 and bring an end to Brexit altogether? These are all the kind of options being discussed this evening because nobody knows, Marco, where we're going to be.
Yeah, well, the hashtag May Must Go has been trending. We'll see. Our guide through the Brexit wilderness, the world's Orla Barry in London. Thanks very much, Orla.
Thanks, Marco.
You don't have to hear a lot from Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte to realize why he's so controversial. Here he is promising to use violence to tackle his country's meth epidemic.
My campaign against drugs will not stop until the last pusher and the last drug lord are...
That's Duterte pretending to slit someone's throat. As president, he's kept his tough-talking promise. Since he took office in 2016, thousands of alleged pushers and dealers, and also drug users, have been killed by police in the Philippines, with no trial. Reporter Aurora Amendral wanted to learn more about what made Duterte the kind of president he is today. So she visited his hometown, the city of Davao, in the southern Philippines. Duterte was the mayor there for more than two decades, credited with making the city relatively safe. It's also where his family has had a hold on power for generations. Here's an excerpt from the story Aurora reported in Davao for PBS Frontline's podcast, The Frontline Dispatch.
15 minutes from downtown in a leafy gated subdivision is the house where Duterte grew up. His sister lives here now.
We're here to visit Eleanor Duterte.
A security guard opens the gate. It's a simple two-story house, a little rundown. Inside, there's a small Catholic chapel. On the wall are the Ten Commandments, Duterte's presidential portrait, and a drawing about 4 feet high of their mother, Soledad.
I am the oldest daughter of Soledad Roa Duterte, and I am the older sister of Mayor Rodrigo Roa Duterte.
Eleanor Duterte is thin, 76 years old, 3 years older than her brother, the president. She's wearing Chanel earrings, some jade bangles, and a striped shirt with a Mickey Mouse applique at the center. She lived in California for more than 30 years. After she retired, she moved back to the family home.
All I can say is in his heart, he's guided by God. Trump is also guided. Xi Jinping is guided by Putin. I'm not saying they're saints, they're human beings. But they're guided by a higher force. They're not guided by Darth Vader. They're guided by the light of God.
Eleanor says her brother got his sense of discipline from their mother.
When he does something stupid, like he's found on a rumble, then the police comes in and knocks on the gate and says, Rodrigo's in a rumble. Here you go again. He's asked to kneel. We have an altar upstairs with a crucifix, then he kneels.
She tells me their mother punished her brother by making him kneel in front of the family altar. In some tellings, he's kneeling on mung beans. She made him hold out his arms.
The arms out is like a crucifixion, you know.
Did your mother used to whip Rodrigo?
Whip?
Yeah.
He has been whipped so many times.
Eleanor has a favorite story about Duterte as a kid.
So one time my parents were not here. So my brother came home and he had nose bleeding all over in the face. And I said, what happened to you?
Duterte told his sister a group of kids had ganged up on him and beat him up.
I said, okay, come on, let's go. I bring him to that group and I said, is it true that you were fighting here? And then is it true that, you know, you were not fighting fair and square? So the kids were silent. Which of you did the punch? He was bleeding. One kid says, he did it. And the other kid, no, he did it. So they were going like this. So I pulled the youngest and the shortest. I took hold of him, and I know what a chokehold is. A chokehold is that you put your arm around the neck. So the kid was saying, I said, you tell the truth. Who's the captain here? So he pointed to the tallest guy. So I said to the tallest guy, the next time you do an unfair fight, you're toast. Remember that. You will answer to me and you're toast.
When Duterte was 14 years old in 1959, his father, Vicente, became the governor of the province of Davao.
He was a very peaceful, mild-spoken man. But when he lays down the law, he lays down the law.
The Duterte children grew up surrounded by politics. Like many provincial politicians, the elder Duterte held court at home, dispensing orders, advice, and favor.
He told Rodrigo that when you enter politics, you must be very clear with what you want. There are many forces that will oppose you, and you have to stand your ground. We are not a military family, but Rodrigo took that to heart.
Their father died of a heart attack when Duterte was just 22.
From that time on, my mother was a widow. She became the father and the mother of the entire family.
Soledad Duterte was a powerful figure.
We were in the logging business. We were in the fishing business. We were in the sawmill business. She was a realtor. She was in the real estate business. She was a teacher. She handled five hats. So who is the hero?
Soledad was also an activist. She rallied against the authoritarian rule of then-President Ferdinand Marcos. And she helped Duterte start his political career.
Do you think your mother believed that he would be able to do something? Why him?
Yes, because he's a very good observer. During my father's time, he learned a lot when my father was governor. He and my father talk, father and son, always during dinner. My father would tell me, one day if you should choose politics, you have to do this, you have to do that. So my mother knew that of all his children, Rodrigo is the most prepared to enter public life.
Their mother was by Duterte's side until she died in 2012. She remains a towering presence.
Look at him today because he learned this lesson. You know, when he has a problem now, he goes, he cries in the mausoleum where my mother's ashes are buried. He tells my mother what his problem is. He cries there like a baby. Because the only person he really listens to is my mother. There's no other.
Aurora Almendral reported that story from the Southern Philippines for PBS Frontline's podcast, The Frontline Dispatch. As you just heard, she learned a lot about President Rodrigo Duterte from speaking with his sister, Eleanor. I just had to ask Aurora, though, what was that experience like?
Eleanor is eccentric, very much a big character, and makes sense that this is the kind of family that he comes from. When I met her, we ended up talking for 3 hours. She was just going on and on, really in much the same way that Duterte does about all of her ideas. But she also told me some stories about him when he was a child.
Yeah, well, it sounds like she could have been president, too. She told you, though, when he was a kid, he'd get into a lot of trouble. And his mother, their mother, was a tough disciplinarian.
Well, he would get punished by his mother, who sounded like a very exacting woman. His mother had this horsewhip, and when he misbehaved, which sounded like it was quite often, he would get a whipping. In some way, it seems like he's emulating what his mother did for him. He was an unruly, bad kid, constantly getting into trouble, but with lots of discipline and tough enforcement, he became the person that he is today, which in his estimation is the right kind of person.
And the city of Davao itself, where he grew up and served as mayor. How did that kind of whole experience affect how he is as president?
So in the 1970s and the early 1980s, Davao was an extremely violent place. This is a time when Duterte is growing up. He's becoming an adult. He becomes a prosecutor, and he's dealing with cases that are genuinely heinous. There are rebels everywhere. There are vigilantes and insurgents. It's just, for years, was a very tumultuous time in Davao. So this idea of bringing security to people, stemming the violence, is something that really formed him as a person, and that's what he claims to have brought to Davao in the over 2 decades he was mayor, and that's what he says he's trying to do to the Philippines now.
Aurora, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You can hear the rest of reporter Aurora Almendral's story about President Rodrigo Duterte on the Frontline Dispatch, the podcast of our partners at PBS Frontline here at WGBH. A follow-up now to a story we brought you earlier this week. Japan's greatest baseball player, Ichiro Suzuki, simply known as Ichiro, was capping off a 19-year major league career in Tokyo. MLB opened the season in Japan at the Tokyo Dome yesterday and today. The 45-year-old Ichiro had refused to say if these would be the final games of his career. In the eighth inning of today's game, the Seattle Mariners manager pulled Ichiro from the outfield.
Major League field.
The fans and players saluted him for several minutes with a standing ovation. Ichiro was emotional as he hugged his teammates and coaches, and after the game, he did make retirement official. He said it doesn't get better than tonight, that there is just happiness. Ichiro walks away from professional baseball with the most hits in the history of the sport, 4,367 when you combine his time from both the U.S. and Japan. Wow. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Comparing the current state of our country to Rome before the fall of its empire might sound a bit far-fetched. Or to paraphrase Randy Newman and his song, A Few Words in Defense of Our Country, you could argue things were definitely worse in the final years of Imperial Rome.
Take the Caesars, for example. While the first few of them, they were sleeping with their sister, stashing little boys in swimming pools and burning down the city. And one of them appointed his own horse to be consul of the empire. That's like vice president or something. That's not a very good example right now, is it?
Okay, we don't have a horse as vice president, but we do have a ruler who tweets while Well, while a lot of things seem to be burning, so let's see if there are any legit comparisons to be made here. Barry Strauss is an expert in all things Roman. He teaches classical history at Cornell in Ithaca, New York. His latest book is 10 Caesars, Roman Emperors from Augustus to Constantine. When I'm trying to compare Roman emperors to Donald Trump, Barry, the first one that springs to mind is Nero, who fiddled while Rome burned. I'm not the only one who's made this kind of easy comparison. How apt is it? Right. And do you as an expert see similarities?
Well, there are some similarities. Nero and Donald Trump would agree that politics is showbiz. After all, Trump had a successful career in showbiz before going into politics on The Apprentice. And likewise, another thing they have in common is that they're both builders. Nero wanted to rebuild Rome, and Trump, of course, had a reputation as a builder before going into politics. You know, the funny thing about Nero is that for all the bad reputation that his personal life deservedly gets, he gave Rome pretty good government. He gave Rome a period of peace and prosperity. If we want to point to some things that he did that were not good, the way he treated the provinces, let's say the allies, in the case of Trump, under Nero and under the governors who mistreated the provinces. I think there are other emperors who Trump should also be compared to. I don't think that Nero is the only analogy.
Which emperor do you think is closest to Donald Trump?
So one is Augustus, because Augustus was a genius at branding. As you know, his name wasn't Augustus. He was born Gaius Octavius. Then he was adopted by his great uncle Julius Caesar, and he became Gaius Julius Caesar. And some people called him Octavian. And then finally, he took the name Augustus, which means reverend. So that's a sign of his branding. Also, he had a slogan, "The Republic has been restored." Now, the one thing that Augustus did not do is restore the Republic. He turned the Republic into an empire, but this was his slogan. Likewise, Donald Trump has a slogan, "Make America Great Again." And I think both men would have agreed that slogans are tremendously important.
Well, talk about branding. I mean, he got a month named after him. Maybe not while
he got a month named after him. Other emperors wanted to have a month. Nero wanted a month too, but it didn't stick, fortunately.
There was never a female emperor ruler of Rome, was there?
No, there never was.
But can you think of any parallels in ancient Rome for somebody like Nancy Pelosi?
Yes. So, you know, Nancy Pelosi, on the one hand, is a power broker and she knows how to play hardball. And there are quite a few imperial women who are like that. Probably the most famous is Livia, who was the wife of Augustus and the mother of the second emperor, Tiberius, and certainly played a role in Tiberius's accession to the throne. She was an emancipated woman legally, immensely wealthy, dedicated buildings in her own name, very powerful and very much knew how to work behind the scenes. When she dealt with her husband, Augustus, to whom she was an important advisor, she took notes and she kept letters from Augustus. And later on, when her son Tiberius was emperor, she would pull out these letters and say, "Look, this is the way it's supposed to be done." Mm. So she was taking notes. She was very careful.
And how about somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, well, like Nero, she's a showbiz natural. And I think she does an incredible job of putting herself out there and developing a following. But she's not an emperor yet. At this point in her career, she seems to me more like a figure from the late Republic than from the Roman Empire. To her admirers, she's a people's tribune, like the Gracchi, who opposed the wealthy on behalf of the poor of the Republic. To her detractors, I suppose she's a revolutionary, like Catiline, who led an armed rebellion against the Republic. But she'll be one that we really want to watch in the years to come.
I'm guessing, you know, most modern leaders don't look up kind of leadership and psychological profiles of the Caesars, though, kind of as models for their own leadership. So do these parallels simply suggest that maybe modern leaders, not to mention citizens, don't learn a lot from these Roman leaders, have not learned a lot?
It depends what you're asking there. If you're saying that modern leaders have failed to learn the lessons of history, I would say, yeah, absolutely. I think they've failed to learn the lessons of history, or they could benefit from looking at the lessons of history again. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, no, I think it's true. I mean, I think we can't study history enough. It's not, you know, History doesn't lay down the law. History isn't an iron rule of what's going to happen. But it does suggest some lessons and some parallels that we ignore at our peril. And I think particularly as Americans, we love novelty. We love things that are new. And we don't want to look at the past. We're always looking forward to the future. But the future is rooted in the past, and human experience is very old, which is why I think we need to look back at people like the Romans.
Well, SPQR, we'll leave it on brand, so to speak. Barry Strauss, professor of history and classics at Cornell University. His new book is 10 Caesars, Roman Emperors from Augustus to Constantine. Barry, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
So what's the opposite of ancient Rome? In modern Rome, these musicians might not be emperors, but they do rule pop charts. Takagi and Ketra, DJs and producer remixers. Singers here, you got Tommaso Paradiso, a favorite of younger music fans, and Jovanotti, someone known by pretty much all Italians, young and old. This crew's just come out with this fun track called The Moon and the Cat, La Luna y la Gata. If you see the video, you'd be excused for thinking it's an animated version of Cats, but with a soundtrack not by Andrew Lloyd Webber. And the song? It's about long distance love.
Gli alberi pescano, pescano l'anima di questo mondo, emergendo le radici, abbracciando l'equatore. Vorrei tu facessi lo stesso con la mano sul mio cuore. Quando mi guardi negli occhi, vorrei finire nel frullatore.
Ma dimmi come si può stare bene anche quando si è lontani. E non sento.
An all-star Italian lineup there with La Luna y la Gata. We'll leave it there for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.